Welcome to the Work Revolution podcast, where we believe, in fact, we know, there's a better way to work and live. And we are here to challenge the status quo of obsolete workplace practices and ideas about leadership. I'm Lisa.
And I'm Deborah. Along with you, our listeners, we're evolving our thinking about what it means to belong, innovate, and create change at work. Join us as we dispel the myths of meritocracy, hierarchy, and other bullshit practices that get in the way of all of us harnessing our full potential to make a better world. Welcome back to our listeners. Today we are talking about the movement of moving from a 5-day to a 4-day work week. And here to offer his expertise in this discussion is Andrew Barnes. Andrew is the founder of the not-for-profit organization 4-Day Week Global, as well as the founder of Perpetual Guardian. He is described as an innovator, entrepreneur, and philanthropist. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Deborah. It's great to be here.
Good to have you. To start off with, tell us a little bit about the organization 4-Day Week Global, what they're doing. I've seen it and heard it described as a campaign, a movement, a not-for-profit, a foundation for research. What are y'all doing over there?
All of the above. We're very accidental evangelists for an idea, which is we think that the 5-day work week should be consigned to history, and that the 4-day week, or to be clear, reduced hours working, is actually the way to go. So we talk about a thing called the 180-100 rule, which is 100% of 5-day pay, 80% of the time, provided we get 100% productivity. That's what we are trying to push. And we are working with governments, businesses, academics, all over the world to really drive this movement. And what we're trying to do is encourage people to experiment with it. We're not saying you need to legislate, we're not saying that every organization should be forced to do it. But we're saying, if you experiment, you might be surprised at what you find.
And you were surprised at what you found, right? Because you have your own personal journey to this. So with your own organization. So can you tell me a little bit about how you came to this?
Yeah, look, I was on a long distance flight from Auckland to London, and I was reading a couple of articles in The Economist magazine, and it was talking about productivity in organizations. And what it said was that surveys indicate that people are productive for 2.5 hours, apart from the fact if you were Canadian, so close to home for you, Deborah, in which case you were productive for 1.5 hours a day.
I don't believe it.
Yeah. And I thought, is this true? Don't know. But it might be happening in my business. What is it that might be stopping people being productive as opposed to being busy? Things like external phone calls, too many meetings, interruptions in work, inability to concentrate. So what I wondered was that if I said to my guys, look, I will gift you a day off a week, but in return, I want you to rethink how you work. What is it that's stopping you being productive? And if we can eliminate that, I will give you the benefit of that additional day off. So it wasn't about giving you another employee benefit in the form of a gym membership or higher pension or whatever it is. It was time. You can't put a price on time. Time is extraordinarily valuable. So what I was saying is, look, I'll gift you that. You've got to think about how you might do things differently. And so we ran this trial back in 2018. And what we found was that not only did it make the company better in that our empowerment, engagement, enrichment, team cohesion scores went up 40%. They went up to levels. The researchers we had from Auckland University of Technology said these were the highest levels they had ever seen in any company in New Zealand. We found the stress levels in the organization dropped 15%. More people said they could do their job better working 4 days rather than five. And critically, overall productivity went up 20%.
Wow.
So we were producing more, working less. Our people were feeling better about it and themselves and the organization. And was I surprised? Yeah, I probably was. In the back of my mind, I thought there had to be something here. but I didn't expect to see that productivity itself actually then went up.
Yeah, that makes me think about a couple things. And it was one of the things I was going to mention, because we do have a lot of information now from neuroscience talking about how many hours can a person focus a day, or to your point about productivity. Now, I was going to say 4 to 6. Actually, you read something, a number that was much lower than that even. And certainly in the knowledge economy, this idea of being productive for 8 or more hours a day, because quite frankly, a lot of people have to put in more time than that if they want to, certainly to excel in their career. So what you are saying though, is we're not just talking about cramming all of the work into a four days a week. We're talking about actually reducing the number of hours that people work.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason we say, so that is a reduction in the working week. But the reason we talk about 80% of the time is you have to start to think what time is important to people. So in my organization, when we first did the trial, we said, okay, everybody's going to take a day off. Not always the same day off, because not everybody could always have a Friday off or a Monday off. We rotated it. But when we implemented the policy full time, we actually said, look, you can take a day off if that's what's important to you. You could take 2 half days off if that's what is important to you. Or very much for working parents, you actually could come in late and go home early, but work 5 days a week. Because giving you a day off a week didn't help if you're a working parent, unless we can get the educational system to switch to 4 days, because you then still had all the childcare issues. You give the people the time off that's important to them. Now, that's very critical, because that's the incentive. I'm giving you something that you can't put a price on. I have a chap who's a grandfather in my Dunedin office, and he has 2 afternoons off a week. He spends time with his granddaughter. They do granddaughter, grandfather stuff. They have tea together twice a week. And when he talks about it, he cries, because he would never have thought that he could spend that quality time with his granddaughter. We're giving him that. Now, that means that he's not going to do anything to prejudice what we're trying to do here. And his colleagues have their own great stories, but they also can see the reaction on him. And therefore, this is an accountability issue. You're not just accountable to me as the business owner. You're accountable to your colleagues. You don't waste their time. They won't waste your time. And the reason we do that is because we all get something from this that we couldn't have dreamed of.
And the thing that I'm hearing come across loud and clear, which I'm preaching about all the time, is flexibility and control. And this, again, is really grounded in neuroscience, but people ultimately want flexibility and some control over their working lives and making it manageable with the rest of their life, which is, it's really interesting that we're talking about this in a time when we are seeing a great deal of resistance to, after the pandemic, going back into offices, and the tension that is between executive leaders in many cases and the workforce, where executive leaders, people need to come back into the office. I don't think they have really a good reason. They talk about culture and collaboration. I don't think there's any data I've seen to support this. I get that we need to rethink, to use your word, to rethink and reimagine the way we work. But it's interesting that you're talking about this, which sounds like a no-brainer to me. But at the same time, there's a ton of resistance out there.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, because I think you're right, Derek. So if I walk into a room full of CEOs and say, I've got a business improvement process that will add 20-25% to your company productivity, they're all going to go, yeah, listen, Andrew, that's great. Tell me about it. The minute I walk in and say, actually, but that's by making your staff work less, they all think I'm an idiot. But the next thing that they will do is I will say 4 day week, and they will say, that's great, but how do you measure productivity? To which I reply, how are you measuring productivity? So the problem that you're identifying as well, Deborah, is that the reality is most businesses don't understand productivity. They use presenteeism or hours as a surrogate for productivity. Now, all I'm doing is saying, actually, if you look at the research, presenteeism hours are a very bad guide towards productivity. So when you move away from that and focus on output rather than time, that becomes incredibly liberating, becomes very liberating for the staff. It becomes incredibly liberating for the business, because what you're doing is you are identifying all of those little things that would never really get up to the C-suite that are stopping your people being as productive as they can be. Because if you go to them and say, look, we're going to bring in a consultant and we're going to find out how to take out the efficiency, your workforce hears one thing: job losses.
Right.
They also hear that I'm going to be expected to do more with less. But what I'm saying is, find those inefficiencies, and guess who gets the benefit? You do. You get time. Because I, as a business owner, don't care whether you take 5 days, 4 days, or 3 days to do the job. What I want to know is, I'm going to get the productivity, the thing that pays your salary. I'm going to get that. And if you can deliver that in less time, amazingly, that cascades into lots of other things. It cascades into my heating bills. It cascades into the size of the premises that I need. Because everybody loves it, it means I can attract and retain better talent. It means my sick days halve, and on it rolls. This is a very rational business strategy. But we stop it because we sit there and go, but you've got to work 5 days a week. Now, I always think that back in the 19th century, there was a couple of bewhiskered guys sitting around at some dark satanic mill in the north of England with a bloke walking in and saying, I think we should only get our people work 6 days a week. And they all sat there and said, the world will end if we go down to 6 days a week. And honestly, they were probably apoplectic when somebody suggested that maybe we might drop the 8 hour day. So why is it do we hang around hanging on to a construct of a working week designed for repetitive manufacturing industry in the 1920s and say that has got any relevance whatsoever to the 21st century?
I'm glad you brought up that historical perspective, because it was around about 100-ish years ago that globally, generally, most developed nations went from a 6 day work week to what we now have, what we consider just the norm of the 5 day, roughly an 8 hour day, 9 to 5-ish. And I don't know how knowledgeable you are about that transition, but if you can speak to it at all, what have you learned about how that transition, which to your point, there would have been a resistance, it would have taken a long time, perhaps, I don't know. What have you learned about that is influencing or has informed your approach to this?
So in a lot of cases, people credit the 5 day week to Henry Ford. I'm not somebody who is well known, I think, to be not a very focused and driven business person. But Henry Ford introduced it into his factories. It took about 4 years, I think, to bring across the whole of his workforce. Now, the reason he did it was quietly interesting. He did it because he was manufacturing, obviously, the Model T Ford cars, and he needed to create a market for cars. Now, if you were working 6 days a week, you only had time off to go to church. Now, the minute I gave you a weekend, you had time to go somewhere else. And if you had time to go somewhere else, you needed a method to go somewhere else. So you needed a car. So Henry Ford, by reducing the working week, created a market, which therefore increased the profitability, productivity, et cetera, of his business. Now, if you think about that in today's service-driven society, and also a society where often all members of a family are working and therefore don't have time to do as much leisure as they might do because of trying to fit tasks around the working week, there is an argument that this would achieve exactly the same thing. That what you would find is, by increasing leisure time, you would actually create activity. It would be more time to shop, more time to dine out, more time to travel, more time to be educated and
play pickleball.
Yeah, play pickleball, whatever that right. is. Yeah, a game of waste your life. Clearly, that's the whole point around this.
Right.
That actually, if you've got to look at it in the macro sense, not the micro mm-hmm. sense. If we do this, it fundamentally changes economies. It addresses a lot of the big issues that we talk about, pollution. There is one piece of research said that if the UK introduced the four-day week, the impact on the environment would be the equivalent of taking the entire UK car fleet off the road every year.
Yes, I see.
Now, you want to see COP26 goals achieved. You can do it by rethinking how we work, and yet it doesn't, by the evidence that we see, adversely impact productivity, profitability. In fact, if anything, it does the reverse.
It's interesting because you talked about a lot of benefits that you yourself experienced in your organization, and we had a good list of them going. And I'm glad you did bring up that environmental piece because I wanted to go there. It's important to me personally, I guess, and hopefully to other people too. And I didn't understand that was specifically to the UK, that piece of research, but it said that carbon emissions could fall by up to, assume this number means 127 metric tons. That's pretty significant.
It is pretty significant. The evidence does seem to be, there's a piece of research done out of Henley Business School some years ago, which seems to suggest that if you reduce the working week, people do low carbon activities on those other days. And obviously, you then get different benefits. In a lot of cities, you have congestion, obviously. But if you could reduce traffic flows by 20%, a lot easier now with working from home, you would actually then often get free flow. Now, in Auckland, if we got to free flow, not only would we see a material drop in carbon emissions, bizarrely, we'd see a 1.5% increase in Auckland's GDP.
Interesting.
Because of the time that is wasted stuck in congestion. So this is where I didn't expect when we did, as I said, I was sitting there looking at my little business and trying to work out how I improved its productivity. But now this thing has exploded in all directions. When you start to look at what it can do to the wider economy, the wider community, society as a whole. And when asked, 80% of people all over the world, regardless of country, say, we'd like to work less, please.
Yeah. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about where this is being piloted, where it's been adopted, perhaps. There's probably too much to name, but if you could give us a snapshot. But before we get into that, one other question I have around some of the benefit, and this isn't something I've read a lot about, nor have you mentioned it to date, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. And that's to do with equity, and in particular, gender equity. Now, my assumption is that specifically to gender equity and women's participation in the workplace, which has, by the way, taken a massive hit with the pandemic, that this would actually be very helpful in that regard for reasons that I could go into why I think that's the case. I haven't seen hard evidence of that, but is that something you've noticed? Is it something you're tracking or that's on your radar?
Yeah, no, very much. So one of the interesting things, I think, right from the get-go when we introduced it in our own company was that, as it happened, my head of HR at the time had negotiated a four-day week, 80% pay. And this is something, by the way, that women should never, ever do. Always negotiate.
That.
Everybody's done it. Always negotiate on output. Don't negotiate on time. Anyway, so when we shifted to a four-day week, we said, well, hang on a minute. What are we going to do here? So what we did is we increased our salaries of our women on 4 days to the five-day pay. That was number one. Because we were saying, we knew returning mothers have great time management skills because they need to get the job done and they're generally your most productive people. So that was point number one. We then said, once you're starting going on output, this is very helpful because that means if you can only work less time for family reasons or whatever, actually by talking about output, not time, you can get much better equity in terms of outcome. And remember, the 180-100 formula can also apply to anybody working part-time. So you've got that choice, actually, as to whether you drop the time or almost increase. That's how it works, effectively, because you're doing it on output, not time. The other key thing here is we are never going to achieve what we want to achieve in terms of true equality in business if you don't make it okay for male executives, male workers, to get out. Now, one of the problems I think with this is, and I think this underpins some of the data on the gender pay gap, which I think is misleading, is in general terms, there is often an age gap between a couple. I think it's probably because men are so immature, women marry people who are. If you think about that, that creates a pay gap. And then if you have a child, the logical solution is the person who's paid less, and that's possibly by dint of age, is the one that takes the break. Equally, you know that in society, in a company, you've got a whole bunch of people who aren't going to have those responsibilities or don't give a damn, and they're going to work every hour God sends. So your problem is that for often very rational reasons, you end up with this gender pay gap being created. So when you start to insist, all leaders from the top, and you have to walk the top from the CEO downwards in the 4-day week, take that time now. Actually, that suddenly starts to make it okay to take your share of care responsibilities. It means we're not asking you to work incredibly long hours. In fact, we are quite firm on that. We don't want you to work long hours. We want you to work 80% of contracted hours, because we believe if you are more structured, more efficient, and we change a few things, you will be more productive. And by the way, my leadership team makes better decisions when they're rested and when they have time to think and when they have time to work on the business, not in the business. So what happens, of course, then, is this absolutely starts to balance things up, because you are removing one of those impediments for women to come up. And also at the same time, we're allowing our dads to be dads. The best stories in my company aren't from the women. The best stories in my company are from the guys. I have a chap who walks his daughter to school every day.
It's a two-way street. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of men out there feel that way. I've talked at length about this, and it's something I could go on about. But absolutely, I think that gender equity in the workplace benefits everybody anyways. Yeah. There are a lot of ways about how we're working today that are harmful to everybody. Yeah. There's lots of evidence to show how it's harmful to men. Okay, so let's get back to where I started to go, which is the certain countries tend to come to mind more so than others. But so who's doing this? Who's had success? And how pervasive is it now? Where are you at in terms of the number of organizations, the number of countries that are trialing this, or maybe some have implemented it permanently?
I mean, 4 years ago when we started this in 2018, we were regarded as we're a bit of a freak show. We got a lot of global coverage, extraordinary amounts of global coverage. I think we were the second most read story in the New York Times after the Trump-Putin summit. But that was mainly people being incredulous that we were trying it. Now, what's happened is the pandemic has changed everything. It's forced us to rethink a whole pile of things around productivity, about presenteeism, and about an ability as to whether you can trust staff. So what we've now got is 4-Day Week Global is running pilots where we encourage companies to come on a journey, 6-month journey with us. We put research alongside the pilot so you know what you were like before, during, after, and you've got an opportunity, because this is a very lonely decision sometimes for a CEO to take. You've got other companies on that journey. So we are running pilots now in the USA, Canada, UK, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Israel. We've got pilots coming in Europe and Germany specifically. We are talking to the Scottish and Welsh governments about what they're looking to do. We're working with the Portuguese and Spanish governments and the Valencian government on their trials. You've got 4-day week legislation in, or version of it, reduced hours, in Lithuania, Romania, Belgium, Russia. You've got a version of it in India. You've got governments now talking about bringing it in. So, for example, in Australia, the Victorian Premier says if re-elected, he will introduce a four-day week in Victoria. The first country in the world that's actually gone to a four-day week, bizarrely, is the UAE. And they did it. One, they were trying to align their work week with the Western work week. And of course, it wasn't before because they used to take Friday, Saturday, work Sunday. So they then shifted to that. And then the imam said, we can't even have a part Friday off. It's either Friday off or not at all. And so they said, okay, let's go to a four-day week. So really interesting. I mean, it has now gone from being, I think, what was fringe to being mainstream. It's not necessarily a mainstream policy, albeit there are tens of thousands of companies around the world that are doing it, but it's now talked about as a mainstream option. It's been debated at Davos twice, the European Economic Forum once. It's been in the manifestos of the Labour Party in the UK. Another bill has just been introduced into the UK Parliament. Congressman Mark Tucano has introduced a 32-hour bill into Congress. And there is legislation that's being considered in thinking both New York State and California. This is starting to become mainstream. And we're seeing more local authorities starting to look at doing it. And my understanding is there are 1,600 school districts in the United States doing a four-day week.
Wow. I had not heard that. Didn't hear much about Canada in there. And certainly in my experience, I'm not aware of any companies. It's whenever I bring it up, I do get eye rolls a little bit. Oh, you must be lazy or something. If you want,
let's say 1.5 hours for Canadians. So you only think about it. You only have to be more productive for 18 minutes each day. Make up for that fifth day. It's easy.
Right. So do you feel as though you're near a tipping point then, that this will get enough momentum that it will just start to cascade and be the thing that?
Yeah, look, I do, Deborah. And in the defense of Canadians, I think one of the most successful law firms in Canada has gone to a four-day week. And that was interesting because they had to move away from time-based billing in order to do that. They have done that, and it's been a very successful transition. Yes, look, I think had you asked me 4 years ago, I would have said this will start to become mainstream in about 10 years. I now think that as we grapple with gender, environmental, mental health, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 of the workforce with a stress mental health issue, they are not productive if they've got that. The implications of that can be quite devastating. If you look at the data for lost work time, I think the UK loses 17.9 million days a year as a consequence of workplace stress, health issue associated with that. So if you can eliminate all of that, you suddenly realize that there are very good reasons why we can make this move. And I think that more and more governments are starting to think about this. And what I think we've got to do in the movement is we will encourage more and more companies to do this, which we are. But the next stage of the process is research-driven. So we've got a global research program coordinated out of Boston College and Oxford and Cambridge universities. And what we're doing is the next stage is we want to have randomized controlled research. So at the moment, I can look at the impact in a company and I can tell you at the end of the period whether that company is better or worse. But what we actually want to do is then start to look at the differences between companies who are doing it and companies who aren't doing it and see what happens there. And then also start to gather in this macro data about what is the impact on society. So if I can reduce workplace stress, mental health issues, what impact does that have on the health service? If I can reduce commuting time, what impact does that have on production of greenhouse gases, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think what we are seeing is suddenly organizations, governments are starting to look at this in a different light. It was very easy to, I think, initially just focus on work-life balance, and I've never done that. I've always argued it's a sensible, rational business decision. But now I think we've got the evidence, we've got enough evidence that productivity isn't adversely impacted. If anything, it's improved. And surely now there is enough evidence to support larger and larger trials. And I think that's what we will see. And then I think what you will see very soon after that is you'll start to see countries start to think about this in a far more structured way than we thought of before. So I think this will be mainstream within the next 5 years, which is quicker than I thought.
Yeah. And I would imagine that as that change starts to happen, organizations will also start to realize they're competing for talent against organizations that have implemented the 4-day week. And that might be a bit of incentive as well.
That's right. That's become the number one reason when we talk to businesses that are thinking coming on the trials. The number one reason now is the attraction, retention of staff. Now, that's different from where we were probably 12, 18 months ago. But very clearly now, that's the number one. And actually, I'll go further than saying companies. I'm going to say countries. Because now we're all sitting here with a global talent shortage. So my own country, New Zealand, is now having had what some people thought was a fairly good pandemic because we were able to lock the borders. You would have naturally thought, well, actually, now everybody's pouring in. But actually, they're not. They're actually leaving. And there are a whole heap of reasons why that's the case. Attraction and retention of talent suddenly becomes a national problem, not a company problem. And think medicine is the classic case in point. Shortage of doctors, shortage of nurses. Why do we have a shortage of doctors and nurses? Because they work horrible hours, they hate the job in the end of the day, and then they leave. What about if you reduce the hours of doctors and nurses? Would you need more doctors? Yes. Would you need more nurses? Yes. But not as many as you'd think, because you stop losing the talent from the organization. And also, health outcomes are better. And health outcomes are better then come around eventually in less people coming in for treatment, which becomes a virtuous circle. We can see, I'm drawing a long bow from what was an experiment in a 300-person company in New Zealand 4 years ago to where we are now. But the reality is that's the journey. When you start to question a lot of the preconceptions that are linked to the way that we work, it's quietly liberating, and you can start to see the opportunities that exist for making a better world for everybody.
I love that. What would you say is the biggest obstacle to, let's go at the organizational level to start, just to focus this in. What would be the biggest obstacle at the organizational level to implementing this?
Without doubt, it's your leadership team, all the time, leaders. And it doesn't either within and without of your organization. There is a preconception that working longer equals working harder. That's what I've always had to do. If my people work less, that's going to impact on me. I'll be held accountable if they don't. So getting a leadership team to play ball is really hard. Now, so in my own case, I fixed the board issue. I did own the company, but on half of it, I had private capital investors in with me for the other half. But I announced it on national television, so they could.
That's a great trick.
That was a great trick. And they were desperately happy, but they said, well, we're going to have to go with the flow because we don't want to be the people that said no to it. Now, look, that was a bit of a stunt. The leadership team all hated it. And I had to say to them, look, I'm not going to hold you responsible if it doesn't work. That's on me, right? I'm going to hold you accountable for not giving it a good go. And if you don't walk the talk, if you don't give this a proper go, then, you know, I will hold you accountable for that. And interestingly, within a few weeks, the leadership team were going, actually, my team's more productive. We're getting more things done. We found these efficiencies. I've got more time to think.
Yeah, hallelujah to that.
And suddenly I'm making better business decisions. Your own leadership team is a problem. And I think the other one, on, I wrote this in my book, it was this thing called cows need milking twice a day, which is when you talk to somebody about this, they immediately try and think of an industry which will prove it will not work. So they'll say it wouldn't work in X. In this case, it was a chap talking about the dairy industry. It wouldn't work in the dairy industry. And they don't necessarily work in the dairy industry. They know nothing about that particular industry. But the preconceived idea is it will never work there. Now, bizarrely, of course, there's a piece of technology that's come out of the New Zealand in the last couple of years, which enables you to milk your cows from your lounge room. You can actually do things better. Because if you think what a leader is saying, if they're saying the four-day week doesn't, is they are saying that there is no way they can improve their business. They have reached the pinnacle of human achievement, and that's it. Now, I think that says a lot more about them than it does about the four-day week.
If we have reached the pinnacle of human achievement, then I'm just going to end it now because I'm looking around the world thinking there's a lot of room for improvement.
I totally agree. But you can see my point. That is really what they're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there is no reason that we do a five-day week, other than it's an arbitrary thing. It's a bit of 8 hours of sleep and 8 hours of leisure and 8 hours of work, sort of division of the spoils. There really is no rational argument for it. It's an arbitrary construct.
100%.
And we're hanging on to this for grim death whilst everything else has changed around us. As you said, 100 years.
That's right. The workforce looked very different 100 years ago. So I'll ask two more things before we wrap. One, very broadly, is there anything I didn't ask you that you think is important to say or for people to know?
No, look, I think the number one, two, and three points that we would make to companies that are contemplating this is don't overthink it, and don't overthink it. It's not as hard as you might think. You are empowering people to find a way to work better, and is a direct benefit to them. If you liberate your workforce, you will be surprised what happens as far as the organization is concerned. You know, that is key, because if you overanalyze this, you overthink this, you end up going into a sort of death spiral of trying to work out, how do I make this happen? Because as leaders, we're in the hot seat because we are problem solvers. And what you actually have to do with this is forward the policy and then get out of the way. That's not something that sits easily with a leader.
So they need to get out of their own way, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do. Mm-hmm.
What's the first step you think an organization, if they were curious, if they were contemplating, what's the first step they should take to start to go down this path?
I would say the starting point is go to the 4-day week website, have a look at the material on there, read the white paper, buy the book. Hey, why not? But go and have a look at the material. There is a lot of material. We took a decision right at the very start of this that we were going to share everything that we found with anybody who wanted it. So our research is up there, our legal policies are up there, all sorts of things are up. And what we decided, you don't get many chances to change the world. And very early on in the piece, we suddenly realized that that was what was happening here. And so everything that we've done subsequently says, we're very happy to share everything. And we have a community of companies who are doing this around the world who will also be happy to step up and talk to people who are contemplating it. So go to the website, have a look, and that's a great place to start. And there's lots and lots of information. There's good research. There's going to be more research coming out as the trials start to produce the research, which is coming, the first lot's coming next month. And it's not the difficult decision it was 4 years ago. There is good, solid evidence why this is something you should look at.
That sounds like a great spot to end. I can't thank you enough for doing this. And it's been quite inspiring, actually, because I have some days where I think, oh boy, this is a pile of poo. And like you said, how many chances do you have to change the world? And change the world, I feel like we must. Andrew, thank you so much for doing this today.
Thanks for making the time to talk to me.
It was a pleasure.
Wow, what a fantastic conversation that you had with Andrew Barnes. Deborah, great interview. I thought I knew a little bit about the 4-day work week from what I'd read, but the compelling evidence, the fact that Andrew has personal experience with this, which is what started him off on this, it was just such a compelling conversation. And a lot of what he said, I think I knew it intuitively, but I wouldn't have been able to verbalize it the way that he did and how he talked about all the benefits. I guess my question to you is, as you were having this conversation, did you have any aha moments, or did you have a bit of a similar reaction to me? It was like, yeah, this makes sense. Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. What was your sort of overall takeaway after you talked with him?
Yeah, I think similarly to what you're saying, it was really validating. He's coming at it from a slightly different angle and from a different perspective and with different data, but it's really validating. And just, yes, I was just felt like saying, yeah, I know, that's what we've been trying to say. And he and I joked a little bit, or maybe a little bit more before and after the actual recording, because I had mentioned the name of Brené Brown, and he's, who's that? And he said, I don't read business books. And not that she just exclusively writes business books by any stretch, but you and I have been coming at this from deepening our knowledge around the behavioral sciences, neuroscience, all of the reasons, the data to support workplace cultures where people can be effective and environments and how long a person works. This hustle culture that we're in, which sometimes rewards people for behaviors we don't necessarily want to reward, and penalizes other people who maybe are more encumbered by outside responsibilities, for example. And it was really validating. And I think one of the things that really stood out to me was that his experience and the data that they are compiling based on the lived experience of organizational leaders in terms of productivity gains and the other benefits that they're reaping is really powerful. And I think it's something that leaders are more likely to pay attention to than the other data that is also very compelling and important. But I think this will be something that they can relate to a little more. The other thing that really struck me, again, very validating, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. When I said, what's the biggest challenge? And he said, leaders are the biggest challenge. They're getting in their own way. They're overthinking it, or I think it boils down to some form of fear of losing control, losing authority or something, because I did equate it to what we're seeing with work from home and come back to the office and the tension there. And we're not seeing a lot of data to support that, you know, it in fact, having people in the office does improve culture or performance or collaboration. I haven't seen any of that at any rate. And you and I are paying some attention to that. So I think the fact that he said that, and he has been the CEO of a company and he has had that experience, I think it just lends a lot of credibility to it.
Yeah, I would say in regards to that, it just seems that some belief systems are so entrenched that even facts can't move them, right?
Yes.
It's, I guess for some people, they have to really, and this, we're talking about 4-day work week, we could talk about other things, like people have to experience it to see the benefits, because the belief systems are so entrenched that you need to have bums in seats and hours on spreadsheets as opposed to showing that things are getting done and that you're having impact. Isn't every business in the business of making things happen and creating value, whether it's through a product or a service? The example that Andrew gave about dairy, I thought was really interesting, because I also found myself going to, I'm sure in some industries this can't work, but then I thought not everybody might be working the same 4-day work week. He talked about different ways where people, the example he gave of somebody who took 2 half days off or a shorter week, had time with children or grandchildren. People will make these situations work. They will be productive when they actually see the benefits for themselves. I've had experiences in jobs, and I don't want to call myself out for being a slacker, but it might sound like this. But there are times in my life during my workday, I have tried to find things to keep me busy because what I was being paid for was done and I couldn't move a project any further. And maybe you could argue that I lacked initiative to start something else, but it wasn't required of me. And there's a lot being left on the table if people are just at work in order to be present. And I think one of the things that he said here was that presenteeism and hours worked are not a good measure of productivity or profitability. And that, I think, is something that all organizational leaders need to get their heads around.
And Gallup now has got some really compelling data. One of the initiatives that they are trying to push forward to convince leaders to pay attention to is to make well-being metrics, employee well-being, to make that a key performance indicator, to factor that into measures of success and productivity, because it will have a huge impact. Yeah, I thought it was a really great conversation. And I think the key takeaway is whether it's a 4-day. The other thing that's really interesting to me and I'm curious about, and I don't know enough about it, is what was this like 100 years ago when this transition happened? We can learn a lot from history. So I'm curious to know how long. Of course, there were people who deeply resisted that transition, like any transition. There's going to be people who resist. But yet somehow we went from a 6-day work week to a 5-day work week that has become so entrenched as the norm. So how did that transition happen?
I don't know my labor history in any great detail, but I know that unions were definitely a factor in this. People were dying on the job. You look at some of the outcomes of the Industrial Revolution in England when it was, I believe it was in the cotton mills where people were women, children, men. These were very dangerous conditions and people would be working on one job and they say, we actually need to be more productive. We're going to give you 2 jobs to do, but we'll slow it down so you have enough time to do it. And then slowly they would speed the work up again. So now you're doing twice the amount of work in the same amount of time. People are inhaling things that aren't healthy for them. They're completely exhausted. It got to the point where working people to the bone just was not as productive, and you had unions coming in and people being willing and courageous to put their foot down and say, I'm not going to live like this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a bit of what we're seeing now. People do not want to spend their entire lives in some sort of indentured relationship to an employer. And frankly, when you made a comment at one point in your conversation with Andrew about something along the lines of, we've been indoctrinated into the more hours you work, that's how you climb the career ladder. I'm seeing with some of my coaching clients and conversations I'm having and what I'm reading, people aren't really looking to climb any ladders anymore. People are really wanting to deepen their relationships. They're wanting to have time to do other things and not acquire as many possessions. The challenge now, of course, in an inflationary environment is we do need a bit more money to live the lives we want. And there's a lot of insecurity all over the world around whether it's war, financial situations, et cetera. But I think at least in the West, there is a bit of a tendency to really question this idea of productivity and growth at every cost. I do want to say one thing I found really interesting, both what Andrew said, and I took a quick glance through the white paper that he encourages listeners to go have a look at. And when you look at the recommendations, this one, I really loved this. The top recommendation is to give employees plenty of time to think about how they can work differently and encourage them to come up with their own measures of productivity. Give it to the people who are doing the work. Create the conditions for them to figure out, because people will be able to do that. If someone ever asked me that question, like, how can we make you as productive or more productive in less time? I would jump at that and I would find those things. And one of them, I think, would be meetings. I think that's been a big issue. I know, and the data says that people have been in far more meetings during the pandemic and working online than they have otherwise. But this idea of democratizing or creating a participatory environment for people to have a say in how this could work, I love it. It's foundational to people's sense of agency. And you talked also about flexibility and control. People know how to figure this stuff out. So give it to them. And that's what's going to make it work.
And that's where I get a tiny bit frustrated, because this has been something that's been talked about for a long time. Things like job crafting and people want autonomy. So giving people that autonomy to have some say and control over how they do their work, this is something that's been talked about a long time. So I am having a little low grade level of like frustration that this is what it's taking now to finally have people pay attention to some of this stuff. The other thing that struck me as you were talking about your experience with some of your more senior level coaching clients who are not necessarily looking to spend more time at work and are reevaluating the place that work holds in terms of the greater context of their life. And what's really interesting to me is that when people like that have those conversations and say those kinds of things, oh, wow, this is amazing, right? These people, they're reevaluating. This must be an important trend we're seeing. And they're seeking whatever it is, greater balance. They have their reasons for not wanting to put so much of their time, energy, focus only into work. And we look at that almost in a respectful and celebratory way. However, if we contrast that and say, what happens when more junior level employees try to take that initiative. What happens when people who are maybe more in labor jobs or in the service sector or just in more junior level positions in organizations and in businesses do that? We call it quiet quitting. And I think there's almost a class distinction that is bubbling up as, I mean, everybody in the workforce is potentially reevaluating these things. Of course, the pandemic, we could make arguments that's been, has had a significant impact. But I just think it's interesting to notice that difference.
Yes, differences, whether it's across age or across gender. This is my own thinking around all of this. Many of us have not had experiences of understanding on some level that we're going to die at some point. And I think the pandemic brought this idea of mortality and insecurity and uncertainty a little bit closer to our brains. We weren't pushing it away or denying it quite so much. And when you realize in a more, in a deeper way or broader way, that this is the life you have and how do you want to spend it, it does influence the choices you're going to make about how you want to spend your time. You and I are later in our careers, and even though we might not have the same day-to-day responsibilities as with younger children, or there are other things that we want to do or be or experience or see or maybe even have in our lives, feels like a bit of a now or never. And I think that's a little bit bleeding into many different parts of our economy, the way people think. There's a lot of shifting of people's priorities, I think, that's happening. And part of that, I think, was accelerated by the pandemic. The point you make, which I still am so fascinated by organizational leaders and executives who want people to come back to work. Come back. Come back. And what are they offering? Same old. And this fallacy that you need to come back to collaborate and be part of an employee culture that's rich and stimulating. No one's asking for that. People are actually feeling more involved from in working from home. There's studies coming out that say all of that. So this come back to the thing you said months ago about how many leaders, executives, CEOs are basically science deniers. We have tons of data about how the brain works. We have tons of data about what makes people happy and productive. We have tons of data around collaboration and many things that go into creating happy and healthy organizations. And there's this unbelievable pushback, again, the idea that beliefs are more important than facts. And you and I having these conversations, a conversation you had with Andrew and other guests that we've had, is really pointing to the fact that people are not quite listening to what we know is going to work, to everyone's detriment.
Absolutely. And so I think these changes are coming, and they're, I've been sensing this kind of a bubbling up, and that's why I called it work revolution. Including my science denier comment, which I've used a few times. The other thing I would say is that organizational leaders have been really pushing this change agenda down their workforce, right? For quite some time now, we started talking about change and doing change workshops, and there's change agility, and the phrases change from time to time. And I've been in environments too, where it's like, you guys have to change. And now I think, wait a minute, you have to change. Why aren't you guys willing to change? They're not showing change agility. And so start walking the talk and demonstrating that you can adjust and that you are open and receptive to what's happening in the greater environment, that you're open and receptive to listening to what the data is saying, where the science is going, and what your workforce is telling you that they need in order to do their best work. It's not to say you're going to be able to grant everything or that there won't be some negotiation in that process, but you got to start somewhere.
I always feel controversial when I say this, and maybe it is a very controversial comment, but I strongly feel that you cannot put leaders in place to lead change who have not gone through a significant change in their own lives and have managed through the emotional side of change. And this whole idea, it's just business. Like, our brains don't know if it's personal or business. Our brains react to change regardless of where the change is happening, whether there's a death in the family, going through a separation, or something at work that's related to the loss of a job or the loss of status. Our brains react the same way. And so I think it's important to put people who are going to be leading change and transformation initiatives, put people in place who actually understand that it is an emotional journey that they accompany their teams on and not that they push it down. But the one last thing I want to say about some of the things that Andrew talked about, And again, I love that he's suggesting to companies to do this as a trial and as an experiment. Don't believe me. Get your own data and see if people are less stressed. And I love that his organization helps do the pre and post. Okay, let's start you off here. Let's get some data on how people are feeling, what's getting done, output, well-being, all of that. And 6 months later, let's look at what's changed. The data you can see in his white paper is, or the white paper that they created, shows like significant change in all of those things. And he says here, and be clear about what you want to achieve at your company. If you're a leader, right? Do you want to increase engagement and productivity? That's a reason to go to a four-day work week. Do you want to reduce absenteeism and presenteeism? That's a reason to go to a four-day work week. You want to increase retention, attract quality candidates, motivate people, better culture? That's a reason to go to a four-day work week. So why not try it?
And it doesn't have to look the same for every single company, but it will be mm-hmm. interesting to see if we do get to at some point in our lifetime where it becomes the norm. Because I think the theme right now is, okay, you could just do fewer hours. He said not everybody is rigidly stuck to must be 4 days. Maybe it's just you shorter days, whatever it is. It will be really interesting. I'm just really curious to see what the next 10 or so years bring. And if this does become the new norm, it would be really interesting. And of course, that will happen at many levels, including government and things like that. He did speak to all of the different layers to this that his organization is working on. And he spoke to the bill, for example, that's been proposed in the UK. To reduce the number of hours in a work week. So be interesting to see if that ignites a global thread. I don't know. We'll see. I'm curious.
Yeah. See. And I loved all the talk about the downstream effects on the environment, on people's yes. mental health. We need to think systematically or systemically. We're not just doing one thing. I think that the fallacy here is people think, oh, my employees are going to work for 4 days. They're going to get paid the same amount. And basically, I'm getting one less day of work out of them, as opposed to the productivity is going to go up. My profitability is going to go up. I'm going to be paying less for sick days. People are going to be happier. They're going to be more rested. They're going to take better decisions. So looking at the things on the plus side to trying this experiment, I think is a place where CEOs need to invest a bit of their time in thinking. Maybe if they were working a four-day work week, they'd have more time to think about how to do this.
Exactly. They'd have more bandwidth to evaluate it, maybe think more clearly, make better decisions. That's a little poke. Yeah, I think that was a great conversation. I'm really happy that Andrew agreed to it. And this is something I'm going to continue to keep an eye on. We will put links, by the way, to their website, the white paper, some of the other resources that Lisa and I have read in preparation for this and have referred to today. All will be in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can do that through our website at www.workrevolutionpodcast.com. We are also active on LinkedIn and social media. So please do reach out. We'd love to hear from you. And that's it for today. Thank you, everyone.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe and give us a review. And follow the Work Revolution podcast on Instagram for more great content and updates about our work.
In addition to 2 full episodes a month, we have a monthly Ask Us Anything, where we answer your questions about leadership, career maneuvering, and whatever workplace challenges you're facing. Submit your questions to our website at workrevolutionpodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes as well as learn more about who we are.
Thanks to Bernie at Blue Eye Music for our music theme and to the team at Podatize for production support. Until next time.